You know me, I'm just trying to grow my hair back.
Good luck, man. Good luck.
I'm trying to catch up with you youngins.
Hey, man, I'm a millimeter about a week. And, you know, after a little
like you, I remember when I was a kid, I used to get the skinny where the barber would just cut your hair down. It was like just little nubs left.
Oh, yeah.
And so now I'm at a point where there are no nubs. It's just nothing there. So it's, I'm longing for the nubs. Give me.
But you're holding on to the cul-de-sac, though. It's very distinctive.
Yeah.
I don't think I can ever do the cul-de-sac. I respect it on you, but I just, you know, for me, that day, when that day comes, it's all got to go.
He just cut my head a cul-de-sac. Okay. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Yes, it's me. It's Michael Steele. It's always a pleasure to have y'all in the house. Great for you to drop by for another great conversation. I'm excited about this, brother, because, you know, you talk about the up-and-comers and, you know, the rising stars. Well, this brother's already here. You know, the star is lit, it's bright, and he's doing his thing. Don Calloway is a Democratic strategist and the CEO and founder of Pine Street Strategies. He's an attorney and a former member of the Missouri House of Representatives. He's also on the advisory board for the National Voter Protection Action Fund. Welcome, brother, to the podcast, man. There's a lot to sort of get into. And I want to start a little bit in your backyard because of what we've seen happen. And as a former representative in the state House, you have a probably really good sense of what's going on the ground, particularly in the voting space right now in your state. As we look at what's happening in other states like Georgia, Florida, Arizona, Pennsylvania, this effort to sort of push back on voting rights and what that may mean. How are you assessing where things are right now in that space? In a state like yours?
Yeah, so I think that everybody needs to understand on a macro level that it's not just Georgia, right? It is, Georgia is big because of A, the magnetic Stacey Abrams, but B, it happened on the immediate heels of the flipping of the Warnock and Ossoff Senate seats, right? So the knee-jerk reaction was just so blatant, but the substantive policy is not just Georgia. It's 43 states in this country. Now, granted, a lot of those states are led by Democrats, and so those bills will not move through the legislature, but a lot of them are not. So you have 25 states in which Republicans control the legislature that have active voter suppression bills in play that either have all or some of the various extraordinarily pernicious and draconian elements that existed in the Georgia bill. Mm-hmm. So everybody needs to understand that this is happening everywhere, and you need to know what your state's legislative session is to understand what the parameters and the timeline are for the battle in your backyard. Now, specifically in Missouri, you have an enhancement of the voter ID stuff, which is, you know, we've had voter ID in Missouri for the last few years, but courts have always beat it down. So they're trying to tighten up voter ID even more in a way that courts have no further interpretation there. Mm-hmm. So voter ID is kind of an annual thing, right? Or biannual.
Right.
That's nothing new. What is new is taking away a lot of the expansions to ballot box access that were created during the time of COVID. And you saw even the most deeply read legislatures made some concessions for ballot box access during COVID, right?
So right.
They removed the temporary expansion of voting hours, remove the temporary expansion of literally number of polling places. They reduced the days of early voting. They replaced the excuse requirement for absentee voting, whereas no excuse absentee is what you did during COVID. And it is also the right policy thing to do. So you took away all of the COVID stuff. But the most pernicious element of Georgia, which is the most pernicious element of all of them, and we'll get to the why on that later. Mm-hmm. But the worst element of Georgia is in Missouri, And that's something that I think is dramatically under discussed, which is this idea that the Secretary of State will have the authority to take over local election authorities in elections in which there are allegations of fraud or disputed, potential outcomes.
Right.
Who gets to decide, right, what is an allegation of fraud? Somebody from the middle of the reddest part of the state gets to suddenly decide what's happening in Fulton County or Atlanta counties. This is one of the classic ways that Republican, deep red Republican radical legislatures and governors exercise legislative white supremacy by taking over, using the state authority to take over local governing bodies, be they police departments or election authorities or public utilities. Republican legislatures take over these spaces where they can't win electoral majorities, and they govern according to these draconian conservative principles, and they effectively nullify the African-American or Democratic leadership that exists in these cities. So you see that as a play over and over and over, really throughout every different silo of public affairs, elections, utilities, manufacturing rules, public employee unions, all of that, right? That is a classic Republican play to take control of these areas that are primarily Black and Democratic. Brief aside, I know I'm ranting here. That's essentially why you had the city of Flint poisoned in water, right? In earlier in this decade, mm-hmm. or actually last decade at this point, because you had a Republican legislature and governor, Brian Snyder, who wanted to assert fiscal control over these Democratic cities. So if cities hit certain triggers in debt or certain financial statuses, the governor would then have the authority to appoint special masters to control these finances in these Democratic cities. And when they do that, they can make decisions like, hey, let's get water from this water source instead of that one because this one is less expensive. Well, we know that that one's been poisoned. Right. And that's mm-hmm. not a secret because GM and Buick have and Cadillac.
Yeah, they avoided water. Using those waters. Yeah.
For years ago. Right.
Yeah, they so were like, no, this water's not good.
Yeah. If you think about, I won't allow this water source to wash my carburetors because it erodes them. What is that water source doing to human bodies? Right. And human bones. And so it's all a part of a general Republican scheme to assert control over Democratic areas. But not your kind of Republican, of course, Brother Mike, but a classic Republican scheme.
We're a dying breed.
Yeah. But now we're seeing it in the voting context.
Yeah.
With these really dangerous ideas that secretaries of state or even governor's offices can take over these local election authorities and ultimately decide what ballots should count and which should not. And if you take away 10, 15, even 5,000 votes, in a presidential election, that could be the difference between whether or not your state goes red or blue, like a Florida or an Ohio.
How does that, in looking at a number of the Missouri laws, and you touched on the elements of those laws, the House Bill 334, which would require anyone casting a provisional ballot to return to love this. So if you cast a provisional ballot, you'd have to return to the polling location with a photo ID for their vote to be counted.
Yeah, that's insane. I mean,
so let me get this straight. So I cast a provisional ballot. So I go in, and for whatever circumstances, they have to issue me a provisional ballot. I cast my vote. Then I have to come back at some point.
Yeah.
And show and present a photo ID in order for that vote to be counted, but you typically those provisional ballots are not, there may be some question about your status as a voter, but those are things that have nothing to do with your identity per se. It maybe has more to do with how they have you in their system.
Uncle Mike, you're entirely correct, but you're thinking too deeply into this. There are a million different scenarios, right, as to why it wouldn't work out. And we could come up with 1,000 unique actually 2,000 unique hypotheticals. But the reality is that any given instance, it creates actual barriers and inconveniences, right, between you and the ballot box, between you and being able to cast that provisional ballot. It creates real hurdles.
So why are white folks so afraid of Black folks voting? I mean, because this is not a new narrative, people. This is a narrative going back to the institution of the 13th and 14th Amendment, 14th and 15th Amendments. So this is not something that is all of a sudden we're now, oh my God, they don't want us to vote.
This is not new. This is not new. I mean, you're right. And I appreciate, man, that any serious discussion about this stuff has to start with history, because if you don't understand the history of it all and the nuances, then you're just playing.
And not playing well.
Yeah, not playing well. People ain't got time to play with issues that matter this much. So 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment create the Reconstruction era. And what we saw is that Reconstruction was the first time, and arguably maybe the only time, in which African-Americans, still not Black women, but African-Americans were fully free to participate in all of the fullness of this country. And that manifested itself at the ballot box. You saw Mississippi, South Carolina have these majority Black chambers in their legislatures. You are one of, I still want to say, less than 25 African-Americans statewide. Three of them, Uncle Mike, came from Reconstruction. This is 1865 to 1877. Right. And you saw the oldest Black businesses date to Reconstruction, right? So it was a shining period in American history. And you saw that grand idiom that the capacity and that the ability of the Negro, the freedman Negro, is every bit equal to that of white men. And they had to put a stop to that shit.
Bottom line.
Yeah. And the way they did it was the Hayes-Tilden Compromise.
That's right.
With Rutherford B. Hayes. You know he won because you ain't never heard of President Samuel Tilden, right?
Right.
So the Hayes-Tilden Compromise said that in order for Southern electors to deliver the presidency to Rutherford B. Hayes, you have to do us the solid of pulling federal freedmen enforcing troops out of the South. Right. So it should be noted that the only time African-Americans have ever had true prosperity and freedom in this country, it was enforced by the federal government, right? And the awesome power of the American military. When you took that away, now you see the Ku Klux Klan. Now you see the Sons of Malta. Now, for the first time, you see organized police forces. You never see that.
You never have. We didn't have organized police forces before.
That's right. And the reason they existed was to make sure these Black people know their place and to enforce white rule, right?
And to be clear, the reason we didn't have an organized police force because of the Second Amendment, which allowed for militia. So should there ever be a need for any type of armed force in response to, in that writing, some foreign aggression or government aggression, the citizens would gather and they would protect their interests.
Yes, absolutely.
But there was real concern about Black folks being part of that citizenry makeup. And they were like, they may have a different outlook on this.
Yes, they can have situation. And Black people have never had our rights to the Second Amendment. Look at the Black Panther Party in Oakland, right?
That's right.
Regularly harassed, arrested, beaten, and even killed for exercising their Second Amendment rights, right? In a way that now you see these white dudes walking into Wendy's with AK-47s just to show that they can, right?
Well, so that never happened. Look what happened in Michigan, where not only did you have armed white men show up on the state capitol steps, they made it very clear of their threat to kidnap and kill the governor. Yeah. And not a shot was fired, nor a knee placed on the neck of those individuals.
That's right. And this isn't even Trump stuff. I mean, 2010, Clive and Bundy, Ammon Bundy, those guys out in Nevada placing armed rifles in the faces of federal law enforcement officers. Now, they were, like lands patrol, but they were still federal officers, right?
Right.
The only time we have ever seen active Black resistance, even if it's peaceful, but with shows of force and carrying of weaponry, Black people got the city bombed them with helicopters in Philadelphia.
Right.
Remember that Mumia Abu?
I remember that very well. Yeah.
That's right. And Nat Turner and Denmark Vesey, slave rebellions in which people were killed.
They just wiped them out. Right.
Denmark Vesey didn't even execute it. They just thought he was thinking about organizing some Black people, slaughtered the whole village. Right. So, this we're ranting here and we're going on, but your point here is well taken, is that the history matters here, right? So this is this voter suppression stuff, it is ramped up and it's newly energized post 2013 Shelby County versus Holder, which takes away Section 5 pre-clearance of the Voting Rights Act, crucial moment in American history. It's new because of that, and it's renewed because of that, and the ugliness of Trump. But this is deeply rooted in the right. American experience, right?
How is the Biden administration going to grapple with this part of the conversation, which you put your finger on an element that is a part of H.R. 1, which has very broad scope on elections and voter suppression, repelling voter suppression efforts. The Biden administration seems to be walking a little bit of a tightrope, but we'll get into a little bit later on the filibuster. But they have some tools in the tool shed that they can use. But to be honest, it seems to me that there's a little bit of hesitancy. There's certainly an urgency within the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party to go big. And I have to be honest with you, I'm kind of out of that school, you know, because that's what I did with the RNC. I figured, all right, fine, let's put everything in the pot. We're not only going to try to get back the Congress and the Senate, but let's go after state legislatures. Let's go put judges on benches. Let's put everything, let's just go big, because after losing in 06 and again in 08, what the hell else are you going to do? You're hemorrhaging support from your base. Your donors are like, oh hell, we're going back to Texas with Bush, you know. What do you then have to reanimate and reconfigure the strategy, which is, I think, the point that the Biden administration find themselves right now.
Absolutely. No, that's a brilliant analysis, both substantive and political. I would say that Joe Biden right now is empowered because he has the majorities in both chambers and the White House, of course, but he has to perpetuate that majority, right? That is unfortunately job one of him as president, is let me perpetuate this majority so I can get 4 years instead of having to cramp all this real good stuff policy-wise into 2 years, right? While I still have the house. So how do I govern in a way that protects or perhaps even expands my majorities in the House and the Senate? The first thing I got to do is put shots in arms and deliver for the American people on an economic recovery package.
Right.
And that's a corporate recovery package. That's rounds and rounds of PPP and small business and restaurant support and economic and business support. But that's also what we just saw with the stimmies hit for real. I mean, that child tax credit, transformative. The $1,400 per kid, transformative. And so he had to do that. He had to craft a plan on that, and now he's got to go sell it and tell you what he did. But also, and I'm gonna land this plane, but also, I got to now deliver for municipalities with this infrastructure package, right? So that probably takes up the balance of this calendar year, and then I can turn to HR 1, because that's gonna make sure that the procedurally we can be elected again, right? But HR 1, as important as it is, it doesn't elect more Democrats. What elects more Democrats is getting these vaccines delivered and this recovery money in people's pockets.
Yeah, and I think that's really sharp analysis. And unfortunately, I haven't heard too many Democrats express it, to be honest, which is interesting for me, because I'm right now listening to the likes of Joe Manchin. And as I got into a little bit, I did a podcast yesterday for another group, and I can't wait till it come out, because it's going to be hot, because I just got into it. I said, you guys cannot be this stupid. Everybody, they spent the entire process of the question sort of pushing up against Republicans. Why won't Republicans, you know, vote to support this and vote for that? And so, I'm like, Republicans are not your problem right now. Your problem is the state of West Virginia and the senator who represents that state. You need 50 votes. We got 50. We're good. So you need to figure out how to hold your 50 and grab one from us. But in case you can't grab one for us, you got the vice president. But you still need 50. And it is amazing to me, Don, that in what you just said, that, you know, there is not a political calculation. I mean, Dems are always great at the emotion. I get it. Yeah. I love the emotion. But I come from a team where we're all about the calculation, the strategy, the short game. Let's say, okay, so how am I going to get those people to do something I need them to do over here? Yes, I can get them fired up emotionally, but I got to at some point give them something else because you put your finger on it. Shots on arms is, at the end of the day, a better motivator than the emotion of the Voting Rights Act. And why is that still a problem?
Why is what a problem?
Why is that calculation of understanding that right now what the president is doing, which I think he gets it. The problem is there's some in this camp who don't seem to get it. And Joe Manchin coming out and saying, well, I absolutely will not support a filibuster and I absolutely am not supporting this package, this infrastructure package the way it is. I'm like, dude, shut the hell up. Play the quiet game in the tent with your team. Work that shit out before you come out blasted. But, you know, some people just kind of get full of their own kind of moment. Lose sight of the politics.
There's a couple things here. So let's separate the internecine Democratic Party philosophical battles from motherfucking Joe Manchin. He's over here, right? We'll get into that later, right? So... let's start.
All right, folks, I just fell out of my chair. Okay.
So let's start with a broader discussion of under the dome federal Democratic politics right now, right? I've got to get shots in arms. I've got to get stimulus checks in people's hands. I've got to get child tax credit in people's wallets every month. And lastly, I've got to get a broad and bold infrastructure package delivered to American cities and counties, right? And infrastructure meaning not just pipes, roads, and bridges, but broadband.
Digital, right.
So a bold and innovative infrastructure package. That's what I got to do, right? To deliver, to even potentially win. But if you're an activist and you're interested in criminal justice reform, and you're interested in voting reform, as you should be, right? And let's be clear, everybody should be interested in all these things. But as you know, some people have their pet issues, right?
Right.
Shit, I don't give a shit. If you're interested in animal rights, right? You have to continue to make noise about your issue and pressure Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Don't forget about us. We're going to let you breathe. We're going to let you pass this infrastructure package. And frankly, you're going to have our votes. We're with you. But I will not allow you to forget about this. And as a matter of fact, on the true inside baseball, if there's an opportunity for me to slide some funding for my pet issue into this infrastructure package, I'm going to do that too, so we can have both discussions at the same time, right?
Gotcha.
But I'm not going to allow you to forget about HR1 and this other stuff, because I'm not going to allow you to say, I did this for you. Let's move on. Right. So I'm going to press you on all this shit. And that's why we got Kamala Harris in there, so she can be in your ear quite regularly about all this liberal priority stuff. Right. So it's a civil war, but it's not a deadly one like your team is having. Right?
We're just taking each other out.
Right? Yeah. We're talking about weighting priorities, W-E-I-G-H-T-ing priorities. Now, Joe Manchin, again, glad we've had a robust historical discussion here, because you cannot detach the idea of why we're in this position right now from the fact that most of the United States Senate represents a fraction of the population. You know, there's so many United States
fair
senators
point. It's a fair
who
point.
Have the ability to determine the course of this country, represent a fraction of the people, a fraction of the taxes paid. Far majority is non-people of color, right? White folks. And so you have to have that discussion about the white supremacist mindsets, which corporally shaped everything that results in what we're dealing with right now. We should never be in a position where a Joe Manchin or a Kyrsten Sinema can hold up, you know, a Democratic majority. That's kind of crazy. But that said, I'm not sure that Joe Manchin wants to move on progressive politics, because he's a Dixiecrat in the truest sense of the word, right? So even if you take away the filibuster, I'm not exactly sure why Joe Manchin is a member of the modern Democratic Party. And if we didn't exist in a two-party system, there's no way he would be in the same tent as AOC, right? Or even Don Calloway, for that matter.
Right.
Joe Manchin has to ask himself, what is it that makes him identify as being a Democrat? And I think that all of us can even say, why are we letting this guy, who represents such a small sliver of our interests, both geographically, population-wise, and philosophically, why is he in a position that he can hold up the entire thing? Because let me tell you what, nobody would stand for this out of Cory Booker. Nobody would stand for this out of, you know.
Oh, they beat the shit out of Corey.
Yeah, nobody would stand for this out of Raphael.
Corey, look, let's be frank.
We would not let a liberal black member hold up the entire constitutional
Corey
process.
Cory Booker's ass would be called before Chuck Schumer. And Chuck Schumer would sit him down and go, okay, let me just tell you so you understand exactly how this is going to work. And this, I can tell you, comes from the White House as well.
That's right.
When we do an infrastructure bill, and we will do an infrastructure bill, your state will have, there will be a line item for your state.
That's right.
And that number will be $1.
And you go home and explain.
And you go home and explain to them why you were only able to bring you $1 out of a $4 trillion infrastructure bill. That's how that conversation went. And it has still boggled my mind why no one has called Joe Manchin up, hauled his ass down to the White House, sat him down and said, Joe, let me tell you how this is going to go. Mm-hmm. West Virginia will get $1. I mean, you know,
because even Democrats, even, you know, the most liberal of us still find a need to try to find some way to cater, right, to these conservative areas, to these deeply red areas, to these areas where they don't much like or tolerate you. They just love Joe Manchin. They don't give a damn about us, right? They don't care about, I mean, you got black folk in West Virginia that they don't care about, right? Yeah. Matter of fact, they don't care about their own people because they let them die of opioid addictions and not expanding Medicare and Medicaid in these states, right? So, you know, white supremacy is so deeply embedded in how we think about things, how we think about power, who we empower to stop the whole damn thing, right? That you can't really detach the history from where we currently are. There is no way that Raphael Warnock, or not even Raphael Warnock, progressive black policy could hold up everything. But when you have an HR 1 that could potentially pass and could potentially be generationally relevant for a diverse, multiracial political body, We're going to stop things over that. Even Democrats.
Even Democrats. So it's not just Republicans, folks. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to have more with my buddy Don Calloway right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Michael Steele podcast. And we're having a great conversation. I lost track of time, literally, in talking with Don in the first half. And we're going to lose some more time, track of time talking to him. Because I want to continue on with the narrative. Because the interesting thing I try to get a lot of the folks who listen to this podcast to do, and they, and, you know, for me, do it in your own way, but understand where these dots are. And that there is a connection, right? So it's not just, oh, this dot is out here. This dot on voting rights is just out here by itself, while this dot over here on what's happening in the Chauvin trial is something unrelated and not connected. Nah, baby, they are all kind of connected. And it's important to understand how and why they are connected. So there's a little dot in between where I'm going to go to eventually on show, because I do want to ask you a little bit about that.
Yeah.
But what we were just talking about was, and you put your finger on it gently, but now I want to press on it. In the state of Georgia, the response to the voting laws there has blown up in ways predictable and in some ways not so predictable. And the not so predictable part was when 72 African-American CEOs and C-suite executives came out and said, now y'all need to get this shit right, because at the end of the day, we want all corporations to call out this suppression and repression of the vote the impact right. that it is having on the Black community. Stacey, I get your vibe. You don't want to, you know, you're running for governor. So yeah, you're not crazy about boycotts. We get it. But that doesn't right. mean the rest of us, I mean, let's call it what the real is. All right. So I'm not, you know, that's yeah. the play. And she got reinforcements from Warnock and, you know, and others. So that's fine. But it was interesting to me to watch these CEOs who have otherwise, and again, we're talking, you know, American Express and I mean, big names coming to the table in that way. How is that dot play in terms of that Black power, that Black voice, and particularly that Black economic power beginning right. to sort of make an impression on these big social issues that are out there, whether it's voting yeah. And then of course how we I think we would respond very differently if Colin Kaepernick happened today for the first time versus yes. when it happened 5 years yeah. ago because yeah. of what we're seeing African-American leaders do.
Man, I think that I'm 41. I think I've lived through maybe five or six discernibly significant social movements, right? So I don't remember what the 80s one would have been, but, you know, 9/11 was one. The world is different.
Oh, the 80s ones was easy. It was just recovering from disco. Yeah.
Well, That was a lot of it.
Yeah, that's basically the 80s, was just recovering right. from disco.
No, I would say 80s is probably like the advent of crack, right? And the war on drugs.
The war on drugs, yeah.
I would say the 90s
again, was like recovering from disco.
Yeah, bro.
The war on drugs is recovering from disco. I'm just telling you.
Probably in the 80s, criminal justice reform happened in the 90s, was a big deal. 2001, 9/11, the world's never going to be the same in a post 9/11 world. And I, you know, I
2008,
think that,
the economic crash where black neighborhoods were devastated on the recovery side because we didn't recover.
That's right. And probably, I mean, and largely still have not, right?
Well, I'm here in one of those communities in Prince George's County. Our home values are just now beginning to turn into the positive. So, you know, you're no longer
the richest Black county in the country.
That's the
wealthiest Black county. Right, exactly. So, by the way, which is we'll have a discussion about the myth of home ownership as well, right? And some next time, right? Because it ain't the same for us, right?
No, it ain't the same for us.
Unless you want to live in a neighborhood where you're, you know, despised and tolerated, right? Tolerated at best. But anyway, we digress. So the mortgage crisis / the Obama moment, I think the world changed a little bit, shifted. And I think that lastly is, I would say the Black Lives Matter movement, but really George Floyd. George Floyd to me changed everything. And if George Floyd is not killed, I don't know that these CEOs feel empowered to speak up in the way that, and by the way, they the boss, right?
Yeah.
but even Black CEOs still report to a board and report to investors and have certain media scrutiny in a way that others don't. And they'll
and
tell
a lot
you
of
that.
Those folks tend to be white.
That's right. Well, a lot of them, right?
Yeah, just keep it, I mean, just keep it honest. Right.
So I think that, you know, this movement that happened last summer through, you know, the fall, because people had time and nothing to do, because people were so frustrated because of COVID, because people had been pent up in quarantine, it exploded in such a way that people made actual changes afterwards. You know, you're seeing an increase in diverse hiring, in diverse business participation, in elevation of Black businesses and voices. But it's not all benevolent because we realize that there's a business case to be made here, right? But nonetheless, I think that the narrative and the mindset shifted so that that in the face of actual and real and objective injustice, people feel more empowered to speak up now, right? And CEOs and corporations are very much included in that.
Should they boycott? Should they have pulled the MLB from Georgia?
Atlanta? Absolutely. Absolutely. And look, man, I have a portrait tattoo of Jackie Robinson on my forearm. I'm a baseball guy. So I know a little bit about it. Yes, they absolutely should have, man, because you cannot intentionally and perniciously oppress Black folks and expect business to continue to participate with you on the same level.
But what about the economic oppression of losing those small business owners? This is their argument.
Yeah, but that's garbage. I mean, it doesn't, there are consequences for your actions. And to host an all-star game is a privilege. To have me come and spend my money in your shops and in your state and give you my dollars, my hard-earned dollars, which, by the way, could go anywhere in the world, for me to come and invest them in your state is a privilege. And you don't get that privilege. It's not an outrageous statement to say that you forfeited that privilege if you are intentionally oppressing Black folks in this state. And that's the same. You know, I was once a member of a legislature when I was your age, and I realized how, like, you know, these deeply red conservative legislatures spend 80% of their time passing these tax abatements and incentives and tax cuts and, you know, for businesses and all these business driven incentives, right? Making the world easier for big business. Meanwhile, the ugly little secret of this is, Ain't nobody coming to Iowa to start the next Apple or Amazon, right? Unless the founder is from there, ain't nobody coming there, regardless of what incentives and stuff. So we're in this race to the bottom to give away public dollars and people's dollars to corporations, right? But on the other, so you have all this pro-business, we're the party of business. But on the other hand, you're literally kicking the crap out of people, taking away women's rights to own their own bodies, taking away people's rights to vote, oppressing gays and LGBTQIA plus community at every step. And they probably spend 20% of the time doing that, 80% of the time on this absurd pro-business bullshit. But this here, this infects everything you do. And people are coming here, businesses that are made up of a millennial and zillennial workforce, Generation Z, whatever the hell's after them, businesses that are made up of that workforce and are frankly led by those younger people, they're not coming to do business with you. We're not coming to invest and play with you if you're fucking assholes, because we don't have to. You're right. Particularly in the face of a global economy, we no longer have to patronize you if you are a jerk to people. Well, so I'm not coming to Alabama. I'm not coming to Iowa, and I don't have to have my all-star game in Georgia.
You're making an interesting argument that I think is missed in the broader discussion of what should have happened in Georgia in terms of response to the legislature's actions there, in that a lot of the gnashing of teeth and moaning and groaning about the boycotts and the MLB not appearing is coming from my generation, and probably right up to your generation, you know, so you're looking at that 60 to 40 year old
window. I'm right in between. Hear all the kids, but I'm more like you.
Right. No, I know. Absolutely. But I'm just saying, but there are exceptions in those groups, you and me, for example, who would say, shouldn't do this for the very, very cogent reasons you stated. What's being missed is today's entrepreneurs are that 25 to 40 year old,
right,
who has a very different political mindset.
Yes.
They take these cultural and social issues very seriously.
Yes.
Whereas certainly at the end of the baby boom generation, we didn't connect those dots the same way. Right. You know, and so we could, in the one sense, you know, witness certain things happen culturally and socially, but not connect them to business.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. And it's crazy. You're exactly right. But the crazy thing about that is that socially conscious business is not new, right?
Right.
ESG, environmental, social, and governance concerns as a core value of business, it's not new, right? So it's 15 years old. It's been around my entire like working adult life, right? And so how far behind are some people in the middle of the country and frankly, unfortunately, leadership in many areas of the country? How far behind are we that we're not even at a 101 level in terms of where business is? Not where it's going, but where it is right now, right? And again, but the people who are generating the tax base, right, are coming from places that are far more progressive, that are far more ahead. And you're going to continue to see this massive crevasse, right, between the flyover states and people at the educational and commercial centers in this country. And that's very dangerous because that's the beginning of civil discord.
So why do you think so many folks, including African-Americans, working class African-Americans, working class white folks, working class Hispanics, going into the last election, looked at, for example, the tax cut, the 2018 tax cut, and thought they benefited from it. When you and I know, and they should too, in fact, if you saw $50 more every 2 weeks in your paycheck, right?
I mean, let's be
versus
honest.
Versus the guy, the guys who live across tracks there who saw $5,000 more.
Because Democrats have not had the intestinal fortitude for generations now to say that, let's be honest, if you get a couple hundred dollars back from a tax cut or even a couple thousand dollars back from a tax cut, you will suffer in the long run because that erodes the tax base that goes into building up our collective infrastructure and community, right? So that's why you don't see neighborhoods getting better. That's why cities aren't all on the smart grid and smart cities. That's why internet is not free and broadband readily accessible to everybody. And that's going to be the key to who's ready to participate and have economic prosperity in the future, right? So these we give upper middle class and wealthy people a pennies back every year so they feel good, so they'll continue to reelect us while we neglect the collective. And that's why our communities have never been properly funded in order for everybody to rise. And that's deeply unfortunate because Democrats have been complicit and compliant every step of the way. Why? Because half of us are Joe Manchin moderate Democrats and the other half want to appear palatable. I heard a woman say palatable the other day. I couldn't believe it. The other half of us.
Dude, like, I was about to say, what the hell is he
talking? What is that, right? But the other half of us, like me.
Is educated, right?
So half of us are Joe Manchin moderates and Claire McCaskill moderates and Jay Nixon moderates, right? But the other half of us are rising climbers. Like when I was a young state rep and I wanted to be statewide someday, so I don't want people to see me voting for a whole bunch of tax increases or against a whole bunch of tax cuts, right?
Especially so if we could like Missouri.
If we could detach our political fortunes from doing what's actually right for people, we would understand that a healthy tax base rises everybody, floats all the boats. You know, these miniature tax cuts for rich people, relatively rich people, well-to-do folks, that's not the collective way to build a country, you know? And I think that Democrats refuse to acknowledge that. And the last element, I know I'm droning on here.
Loving.
Republicans elected a marketer. They elected a carnival barker who marketed to the American people that I cut your taxes. I put dollars back in your pocket. And Democrats didn't have the intestinal fortitude to stand up to that narrative.
I'll let that marinate for folks. I agree with a lot of that. And as you know, a quote fiscal conservative, I've never bought into the full-throated expanse of trickle-down economics because of the problem that comes from it on the spending side. And I think tax cuts, I think a new orientation for the country should be, let's cut taxes for the poor and the working poor and the lower middle classes, because one, there are more of them. Two, they will make better use of it in terms of pushing those dollars back into the economy, right?
Right.
And three, to all the things that you said about what that does from an infrastructure perspective. I mean, in making those, whatever those cuts are, making them available to be put to work in the areas of retooling education in our inner cities, creating greater opportunities for people to actually own their homes as opposed to losing it to gentrification policies. Yeah, because all those tax, those great tax cuts, the way they flow down now, just allows daddy to get his daughter an opportunity to buy that home in upper Northwest Washington, D.C., where I grew up. And now watching all of my mom and dad's black neighbors have to sell and leave.
Which, by the way, those homes will never come on the market because you ain't gonna never tell one of us, right? You'll never tell us that we have the opportunity to get in on this. That's gonna be closely held realty transaction.
That's right. That's right. So there's some fresh thinking I think that needs to happen there. Let's shift gears a little bit before I let you get up out of here. So
this is good, man.
It's really good. It's really, really good. And I think, you know, when I'm looking at, you know, I put out the one dot that we were talking about on voting. And then the next dot was the economic empowerment piece that we're seeing now, that play by black CEOs. The other piece is what we're seeing in the George Floyd case with the Chauvin trial. What for you has kind of been the biggest moment so far in that trial? And how is that dot, and why is that dot important relative to the others that we've been talking about?
Yeah. For me, I don't think that I've had one flashpoint moment. I just kind of watched it and, you know, as a collective slow death march, you know, and grieve every day at the incredulity of it all, you know.
Right, right.
As a lawyer, I'm seeing the defense attorney every day, and I know everybody has a right to a defense and all that. Right. But I just look at him and I think, man, all money ain't good money, you know. Right. I don't care how much they paid you, bro. You know, was it worth this? Because let's be clear, bro, this is you from now until
this is you.
Man, as my mom would say, till you shut your eyes, this right here is you, player. Congratulations. But seriously, I look at him doing his job, and I realize that his goal is to get these kind of poor black folks, these working class folks, these former drug addicts to say that the guy was justified in killing this black man because he was big and black and scary, or because he was on drugs, or because you were angry, so you don't really know what happened, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, man, you know, whose word matters in this country? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whose word do we value because we saw it? Why are we putting the public through the expense of hundreds of millions of dollars and all this trauma and time and attention when we saw, there's no dispute here, right? Mm-hmm.
He's entitled to a fair trial. He's entitled to confront his accusers, right? Even though what we saw what we saw, right?
And I understand, I guess the defense attorney's doing his, you know, zealous representation bit, and I get that, but like, man, it just seems like such a poor use of human resources and capital and everything else, right? When and part of that is like, man, imagine the error. And I guess I'm not making the constitutional point. I'm more making the psychological point, which is, yes, he has a constitutional right to trial, but imagine the arrogance of wanting to play this out to its extreme.
Well, but wait a minute, Don. Think about what you just said and why what you just said is
exactly here. That's my point, right? And that's why it's all connected.
Right,
the arrogance comes from this remarkable place of entitlement.
He figures, well, all look at all these other cases, cops,
it works out. Hey, listen, man, I'm a big boxing guy. So the same arm that has Jackie Robinson has Muhammad Ali on the other side. All I need is a puncher's chance. And the history of this country tells me that if you put me in front of that mostly white jury, even with what we saw on tape, I got a puncher's chance because I am a white man and I killed a big black, scary black man in this country. And I have that badge, right? And so what that means is, psychologically, that means I have this huge advantage because it typically works out for me. But on a practical note, there are people investing in me. I have the I have the resources of police unions who are supporting me financially. I can put up a fight here, right? When brothers are sitting in jail for years for stealing backpacks and stealing pizza, right? I have the resources to put up a fight here because that entitlement, you know, imbues me with unnatural strength.
What's more dangerous, the process or the perception of this trial?
That's a great question, man. That's why you need commentators like yourself and Bakari Sellers to be able to explain to people what's happening, right? And precisely why it's happening and what is happening, because both are dangerous. The process and the substance are extraordinarily dangerous. And part of why they're dangerous is because they are highly susceptible to misinformation. Mm-hmm. So we need lawyers like yourself and Sellers and the late, great Midwin Charles, who we lost this week.
Midwin, yeah, God bless her. God rest her.
Sister. But people like you all are so important, man, because you have to explain to the people what's going on, because this shit is combustible. If he gets off, what we saw last summer, nothing in comparison to what could possibly happen, right? So folks need to understand that when, you know, William Barr rejected Chauvin's attempt to plea in last year, right? Mm-hmm. He attempted to plead to 10 years. Barr's DOJ rejected it after being personally reviewed by Barr because he felt that the streets of Minnesota were the best place to have that trial, right? He felt like Minnesota state and federal and county jurisdiction could potentially better punish him. Now, I'm not trying to give props to William Barr, but what I'm saying, to just say that Trump administration rejected the plea without, you know, analyzing that is very dangerous. That's just one instance where this thing is fraught with potential for misinformation. And we need people like you to be able to explain to folks what's happening so we understand this.
Wow.
And to prevent danger.
Well, I think you explained it very well as well. And I think it's where we are right now. As I watch this unfold, and I think one of the things that struck me in the last 2 weeks was the pain of watching, particularly the older gentleman break down on the stand because he felt guilty that he couldn't do anything to save this young man's life. And that I know, because we're pretty much the same age, I know exactly what he was thinking and exactly what he was feeling and exactly what he was remembering when he broke down, because as he cried, literally I cried watching him and understood that here was this young brother with a white cop's knee on his neck, which was the summation of every dog, every police dog, every fire hose, every lynching, every burning cross in that moment.
Yeah.
And in all of those instances, just like this one, you're helpless.
Yeah.
You're helpless. And you can't stop from unfolding what is unfolding in front of you.
That's one of those things where I have unfortunately seen that video far too many times. And you can't help but say, man, what would I have done if I was there? I would have never, but you would have, I mean, they would have shot you.
They would have shot you.
You know,
and it was very clear those police were prepared. And how do you know they were prepared to do that? From the testimony that the defense is putting out there, that that 12-year-old black girl standing there filming this was just as dangerous as the 6'4" black man whose neck they were kneeling on.
It's crazy, man. And I think that just like you said, connecting the dots, Chauvin was guarded by three officers, only one of whom was white. A black man and an Asian man guarding him, because even if you didn't approve of what he was doing, well, they tacitly approved, but even if they didn't explicitly approve of what he was doing, even if they looked and thought, man, it's going a little too far, who are they to stand between a white man and his ability to give or destroy, you know, and that's kind of fundamentally what it comes down to, is that from the inception of this country, we have empowered and elevated white male patriarchy so much that even in the face of objective wrong, grabbing by the pussy, even in the face of things we know are improper, right? Selling arms to our enemies in mm-hmm. Iran and Iraq, mm-hmm. even in the face that of things that are fundamentally anathema to our humanity, like kneeling on somebody's neck for 8 minutes and 40 seconds, even black people won't raise up to stop it. Because who are we to stand between a white male patriarchy and their fundamental entitlement in this country? And that is the kind of shaping construct for pretty much every institution that governs American life.
Well,
right?
I give you January 6th.
There we go. And you have members of the United States Senate to this day who say that they were hugging police and there was no real conflict. There was never a threat.
Right.
And there are dead police officers. Right.
So, exactly. So, it is exactly as we see it. All right.
Yeah.
You can't.
I'm glad to know I'm not crazy, Uncle Mike.
No, brother. You're not. Don Calloway is one of the best folks. Really appreciate this brother coming out and spending some time with us. He's the CEO and founder of Pine Street Strategies, and not just as an attorney, but as a former member of the Missouri House of Representatives. He has kept it real for us. I really appreciate you, bro.
God bless you, Brother Mike. I appreciate you, man.
Thank you very much. And that does it for our conversation this week, folks. It's always a joy when you get to stop by and hang out at the podcast. You know where to find me on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, wherever you get to download on. Do that download thing. Do the like thing, too. I love it when you like me. Because it's a lonely operation otherwise. But no, it's always a pleasure. You know what you need to do now. Be safe. Wear the mask. Get the vaccine. Don't mess around with that shit, right? Do it right. Until next time, be safe, be well. God bless.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.